You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning at 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this.
The official voice of the UFC Octagon, Bruce Buffer, is on the line. Bruce, you're very welcome to OTB AM. Thank you very much for taking the call.
My pleasure, Owen. Very, very much a pleasure to be on. Thank you.
A lot of people will recognize you. A lot of people will know who you currently are. But when we were chatting about this outside, when we knew you were going to come on the show, the first thing that struck me was how, first of all, you get into the game that you're in terms of being one of the most recognizable figures in the UFC. But initially, what was your relationship with combat sports? Do you have a history in it? Do you have a history in martial arts? And I think you've got a history in kickboxing.
Yeah, I have actually quite a long-arm history. It even starts from when I came out of the womb. My dad was a huge boxing fan. My grandfather is Johnny Buff, who's in the history books, was the bantamweight flyweight boxing champion in 1921. And that's back when there were only nine divisions and the best fought the best, sometimes fighting every 2 months, you know, or even every month at times. So a different world back then. And my dad was a huge boxing fan, as I said. So I was watching boxing as a kid. Huge fan. I had the pleasure of meeting Muhammad Ali when he was Cassius Clay. Right. When I was 5 years old in Philadelphia, and I'll never forget it because my brother Brian and I were at a hotel with my father, and we noticed him. We recognized him from TV, and he could tell we were looking at him, and he came over and talked to us for like 5 minutes. And as a young child, that had a lasting effect on me even to today and in this period of my life, which is one of the reasons that we as UFC fighters and whatever I do, when fans come to us and ask for autographs or pictures, that one memory of me as a child is the reason, one of the key reasons why I'll spend an hour signing everybody's autograph needed and picture, because if it wasn't for the fans, we wouldn't be where we're at. We have to be role models and take care of the fans. So with that being said, I'm getting off subject here. I started in martial arts at 12. My first start was judo. I achieved a green belt. And then at 15, I moved from Philadelphia to Malibu and I met Chuck Norris's fighting partners.
Right.
And I got into an art called Tang Soo Do, which is the Korean style brother to Taekwondo. And that was Chuck Norris's style that he started in the Air Force. So I went on to do that for a number of years and also study in a variety of other arts, achieved a second degree black belt in Tang Soo Do. And then I fell in love with kickboxing because I wanted to, when I sparred, I didn't want to point spar and just hear ippon. You know, I wanted to fight. And I was, like a lot of us when we were younger, I had a lot of fights, you know, of my own style, being a surfer and the territorialism and all the kind of stuff there. So if I was going to train, I wanted to fight for real. So I stayed in kickboxing for some 10 or 12 years, very heavily training and sparring every week. And I had to stop sparring because I suffered what my doctor thought was my second concussion. I was actually preparing to possibly have just one pro fight, just to say I did it, just to put it down, never to want to be a pro fighter. And I got concussed twice in training, and he told me to stop, no more. And I probably had a lot more concussions than that. I can't remember, but, you know, I was 32, and I actually started slurring my words when I got concussed and had some effects. And he said, you know, this is going to go away, but if you keep doing this, you're gonna suffer this in your later years. So just no more head trauma. And that's pretty much my experience, but I've trained ever since then. And it's something that I've just been in tune with. I love the martial arts.
That's incredible. That must have been a real body blow to you at the time, particularly given the bright lights and the money that might have come as a result of a professional career, to be told it's over before it even begins.
Yeah, but again, remember, I was 32. It wasn't an aspiration of mine to be a pro.
Sure.
It's like, you know, you say, well, I'd like to climb the mountain one time and say I did, right? So I just wanted to, there's a place called the Forum near where I live, and they were having Monday night fights, and they used to put on these 3 2-minute round kickboxing events. And at the time, I was starting to manage my brother Michael, and actually I was doing that for a few years. So I had an inroad to possibly be able to be booked for one of those situations, right? Or one of those bouts. And that's what I was training for. And you know, you got to make decisions in life. So it was just a little goal. But it wasn't going to go beyond that. It wasn't about the money. And quite frankly, there's never been any money in kickboxing as a sport, like the kind of money that people earn, thank God, today in the mixed martial arts, which is something all of us have been fighting for, to make sure the fighters make as much money as possible. I want every fighter to make $1 million, millions of dollars. They deserve every single penny of it.
Yeah, they sure do. You mentioned Michael there. A lot of people will know that he's your half-brother. Talk to us about your relationship with Michael, particularly early in your life, because just reading before we came on here, you didn't even know the two of you were related until you were about 30 years old, I think.
Yeah, it was more like around like 29 years old or whatever. Back in the 80s, when Mike Tyson was really getting popular in boxing, was the water cooler conversation on a Monday at the office, much like the UFC is today after big shows. There was Tyson. There was all these great boxers back then. And out came this very handsome, debonair, James Bondish looking individual who added a total new flair to ring announcing, to where we started paying more attention to the ring announcer. And then when he came on with his famous "Let's Get Ready to Rumble," I was a fan. But I was also questioning what was going on, because in my 20s, I owned what we call telemarketing companies. And this is before the internet. And as a natural thing, I looked in every phone book of every city in the United States. I used to have a library of them for my salespeople, right? So I never saw my last name Buffer in a phone book in any city in the United States. So here comes this man on TV, and on the screen, it's Chiron Michael Buffer. And I'm like, whoa, what's going on here? We kind of look alike. We don't look alike. He's much handsome. He's a really handsome guy. You know, this guy's a pretty boy. You know, I'm like, nah, it can't be. So then I started searching around, and I realized that he grew up like 20 miles from where I did in the area of Philadelphia. I called Don King's offices, the big promoter back then. I called other offices, and people started coming up to me and saying, "Hey, is that your brother, that guy that goes, 'Let's Get Ready to Rumble'?" And I go, no, my brother's Brian, who is my brother I grew up with. So now, long story cut short, about a year or so later, I'm driving with my father, and I'm in the car, and I explain to him, "Dad, that everybody's coming up to me. They're asking me who this guy is. We're watching him every week on boxing. You know, any idea?" And I got this. You know, he's driving. I think that's your brother. What are you talking about? And then my dad proceeded to tell me that he and my mom were married for 57 years before my dad passed away 10 years ago. And a loving, wonderful relationship. But my dad never told me he was married during World War II. When he was 20, he had a marriage that lasted 9 months. When he came back from overseas, a divorce ensued, but a child was born. And that child happened to turn out to be Michael Buffer. And Michael was doing a show in Los Angeles, so my dad called the arena and Michael to talk to Michael, and Michael called back, and they got together for lunch and got along famously. And therefore, Michael and I met, and at the time, he didn't have the famous five-word phrase, "Let's Get Ready to Rumble" trademark. There wasn't a hat or a t-shirt made off it. And after traveling to a number of events and building our relationship as brothers and friends, I told him, I said, "Michael, you know, I own two companies. I'm making great money, but I'm burned out. I don't care for what I do anymore." But I was at an event called, remember when Evander Holyfield fought Riddick Bowe? If you know your boxing, they fought twice. It was November 13th, 1992. See, I got this embedded in my head. I'm positive that's correct. And I was sitting there in the Thomas Mack Arena in Las Vegas amongst a sold out crowd of whatever, 20,000 or less or more. And when Michael went into his rumble, I had an epiphany, because here's Hulk Hogan and Jack Nicholson and all these celebrities and all these people. They're going nuts. And I said, you know, something's got to be done here. This has to be trademarked. There's so much more you can do outside of boxing. So I basically got it with my brother, and in so many words said, "Michael, I believe I can make you richer and more famous than you ever dreamed. And the only way I can do that is I want to sell my two companies. I want to devote my entire time to being not only your manager and putting you in every form of sports and entertainment there is, because you're just incredible. But at the same time, we need to trademark this phrase. I want to make toys and video games and, you know, all this stuff." And this was off the top of my head. Mm. That night of the fight, I went back to my room, and instead of going and playing blackjack and having fun in Vegas or whatever you people do, I literally wrote 3 pages incessantly of these ideas that kept coming out of my head. And I saved that paper, and it's in my safe somewhere. And that's what I said. I said, "Michael, I want to do all this." He goes, "How are you going to do it? I mean, it sounds great, Bruce, but how are you going to do it? I'm all for it." And I said, "I really don't know, but if I'm going to give all this up, you better believe I'm going to make this happen." And lo and behold, the rest is, you know, wonderful history and a great partnership between the two of us working together.
Yeah.
And
so
that's pretty much it. Yeah.
So he coins the phrase, and you make it famous, basically, is what I'm hearing there. Like,
well, he coined the phrase, and let's say that he made it famous. I'm the man behind the rumble. I'm the sheriff of the rumble. I'm the marketer. I do the deals, of course, going over everything with Michael and develop the different areas that Michael's been involved in over the years. That's what a manager does. So it's more of a shared effort, but it's Michael Buffer. He created it. So let's just say that Michael made it famous. If it wasn't for Michael, it wouldn't be what it is. And on my part, he wouldn't have done a lot of the stuff that he did.
Do you recall your first meeting with Michael? What was that like? Was there an awkwardness at all meeting somebody who's your half-brother after 30 years of being on the planet?
Absolutely, because there's two things. We met at a restaurant one night where my family was waiting at the table in this Italian restaurant. La Terrazza, I'll call it, Barrington and Welch. I mean, all these things stand out in my head. I know exactly where it was. I know the time. When Michael walked in, remember, I've been watching him, and I don't get caught up in celebrities. I grew up in Malibu. I met a lot of celebrities over the years, and, you know, we're all human, right? People impress me by the type of people they are, not just because they're on TV.
Sure.
So when Michael walked in, I was both a little starstruck because I was a fan. At the same time, this is my blood walking in, and it's in a feeling in my body that I can't really explain. And I think unless you've been through that kind of a situation, there's no way to understand what it felt like. But it was pretty incredible. And I was just so happy that we all got along so well, and it started off so great. I mean, we're all one big loving family, and it's awesome. It really is.
Yeah, it's a great story. And ultimately, the brothers that you are kind of extends beyond the familial links that you share, because in your profession, you're both incredibly well-known people for doing what is essentially the exact same thing, just in two different sports. So was Michael an influence on you becoming the guy that we associate with getting the crowd hyped up around the Octagon and big UFC nights?
Say that last question again, please.
Was Michael, I guess an influence is what I'm trying to say. Was he an influence on you? Because obviously he was doing your role prior to you in the UFC.
Well, yes, he was, of course, because when I was watching Michael before I ever stepped into a cage or a ring and announced for the first time, I was thinking, what a great job. I'm sure people say this about, you know, me at times, and certainly say it about Michael. It's like, wow, how cool. You dress to the nines in a great tuxedo. You travel the world. You get a great seat to your favorite sport. I mean, how can you not love that? But Michael was an influence on me, except I had one goal in mind. And when I decided to step into the ring and then into the cage, because I announced a number of things before, you know, and after I started with the UFC, I told myself that I gave myself 2 to 3 years. And I did not want to be Frank Sinatra Jr., right? And what I mean by that is, I didn't want to go out there and ride the coattails and just be like Michael, stand in the center and be as eloquent as he is. Not that I couldn't assume that kind of a role to whatever level I could do it, but I'm a little different. If you notice, when I announce, I have to move. I get very passionate when I'm announcing. I want to give these great warriors who are putting their blood, sweat, and tears on the Octagon floor every ounce of passion I can give them to enhance that moment for them. And at the same time, enhance the experience for myself, announcing the way I want to announce. So I told myself, if I didn't develop my own style, distinctive style, or start to within 2 to 3 years, that I was going to hang it up. And just I didn't want to be just that guy earning a paycheck, standing center and reading a card. Just I wanted to have a certain identity that I was proud of for myself, as well as what I was putting out there as an image of what I was doing. And that was just a personal goal, just a personal goal. Do you understand what I mean by that?
Yeah, like, It's really interesting actually listen to that, Bruce, because just hearing you do a few other interviews as well, you talk about how what you do in the Octagon is quite a natural thing, how you don't really practice your lines beforehand, you read what's in front of you, and it's just there. Like, ultimately, the two most famous announcers in combat sports are both called Buffer. There must be something there. There must be something in the genes that makes you good at what you do. It's not a technical thing it's not a solely technical thing that makes you good at what you do. Do you agree with that at all, or is that not something you go along with?
No question. I absolutely agree with it, and I'll tell you why. Remember, Michael and I met, we did not grow up together, as you said. Met when I was 29, 30 years old. He was like around 43. I'm 61 now, and Michael's 72. And basically, our dad, Joseph Buffer, had a set of pipes on him that Michael will tell you to this day is the best pipes of all of us. Now, my dad was a Marine drill instructor. My dad was in the Marines for a period of 13 years, serving in World War II and Korea. And after Korea, he was a drill instructor at Camp Pendleton, amongst other things, master sergeant. And when I would walk in a room as a kid, I go, "Hi, Dad." He goes, "Son, project your voice. Let them know you're in the room, right? I'm like 8 years old. Okay, Dad. Okay, that's good. I'll do that. He just had this, you know, this thing. And I was doing some motivational speaking and some other stuff before I ever stepped in to announce. And I have no problem being in front of a group of people. So with that kind of upbringing, Michael doing his thing, yeah, there has to be some hereditary factors to what we do, I'm sure.
Yeah. Like you mentioned the movement in the ring there as well. Like you both rely heavily on your voice, but you rely heavily on your movement, the 180 to 360, whatever it may be. Is it true that you've caused yourself some injuries in the past doing this?
Well, yeah, but the injuries that I caused, I've blown two ACLs at UFC events.
Wow.
One ACL was during the actual fight night, which was when Jake Shields and the great George St. Pierre were fighting at the biggest UFC ever in Toronto, which had 55,000 people and sold out in like 20 minutes, right? It was the biggest show ever. Well, the week before, if you know from reading my interviews or maybe touching on my book, I love playing poker.
Yeah.
Poker's my favorite things to do. And I was in a poker tournament the week before. Now, this is going to be crazy, right? You would think I would hurt myself doing something physical. During the poker, we had a break, and when I'm walking through the casino, there was a dip in the carpet, and I hit it, and my ankle rolled.
No way.
Yeah. So it swelled up. I finished the day of poker, and the next morning, it was like a football. So I ran to the emergency hospital. They drained a bunch of blood out of it. I went back to the poker tournament, played all day, wound up taking third place, winning a very nice sum of money, and that's great, but I couldn't walk. And we were 6 days away from the biggest UFC in history. The Thursday before the show, I still couldn't walk. I started to stand up and I was able to, you know, start moving around. By the time I got to Toronto that night, the adrenaline took over. Every fight went great. I jumped, I spun, I did everything. The final fight with George St. Pierre, when George walked out, I said, "George, rush." And then George lunged out, which he always does. And I bunny hop back when George does that, which I've always done, like a little bunny hop back a foot, right? When I landed that bad ankle, it didn't land firm.
Oh, no.
Wobbled. And when it wobbled, my whole knee exploded, right?
Oh, shit.
The ACL just blew right there. You can watch it. If you watch the tape, you'll see, because when I walked over to Herb Dean after it blew, and when it blew, it was so funny because I say it's funny now, but I went, "George, rush, pop." You hear that pop? I go, "Pierre!" I gave like the loudest ounce of Pierre I could give, which was partial pain and partial vocalism, right? so then I, luckily I didn't fall. And when I put my microphone under Herb Dean's arm, I could feel my knee going back and forth like this, right? So I hopped out. You'll see me hop out on one leg, basically. And then I got out. John McCarthy looks at me and goes, "Buff, I think you just blew your ACL." I go, "Really?" And then Stitch Duran, the famous Stitch man, came, put an ice bag on my knee. What's wrong with that picture? I'm an announcer, okay? And I'm sitting on the side of the octagon with an ice bag on my knee while two great warriors are doing what they do best in the octagon.
Yeah.
A little different picture. The other time I was at, 2 years ago, the UFC asked me to do a lip syncing contest, right? So I went out and I picked Rebel Yell Rebel Yell. Who did Rebel Yell? Escaping me real quick.
It's escaping. I'm not going to be able to help you out here, Bruce. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. It's a famous song. So anyway, at the beginning of it, he jumps. And so when
Billy Idol.
Yes, Billy Idol. So then I do a little jump. And when I jumped, I changed my shoe from a street shoe into a athletic shoe. And I had a street sock on. So when I did the little tiny jump, it came down and my foot slipped in the shoe. And it was a pretty poorly developed stage. It was in sections. My knee buckled. I felt that same pop. And you can watch it on the internet. I don't watch it anymore. I get a little nauseous.
I'm going straight there after this.
Just go, "Bruce Buffer blows knee at lip sync contest." It's right there. So I felt the pop, and then it gave way twice, and 45 seconds or so in, I fall, right? Because the leg just gave way. But I still kept lip syncing on the ground, and then I got up, and I finished the 3-minute rendition of the song. Even did a guitar solo at the end. And then I sat down. I went the next morning to get an MRI in Vegas. This is the time there were three UFCs, one day, one day, one day.
Yeah.
The doctor said, "Well, you severed your ACL. It's gone. We need you to rest and just stay light on your feet for 4 days." And I go, "No, I can't." You know. So I went out and I announced the three shows with one leg. And why? And I didn't have a brace on the first show. They brought me a brace about 8 fights into the show, which you'll see I put on the outside of my pant leg on that show. again, I did the three shows because there's one rule, guys. I've done the show with 100 and plus temperature, blown out back, blown out knee, God knows how many other things in travel. Mm. But I'm not fighting, okay? I'm announcing. I'm not fighting. These guys are putting it all, and the males and females are putting their lives on the line. I can get through a night of announcing with one leg. That's what I told myself.
It's one of the perks of being able to rely on your lungs, but that you can depend on one leg. Before we let you go, we're just stuck for a small bit of time, Bruce. I have to ask you about the big fight.
I'll give you as much time as you want. I've got 15 minutes. You take whatever you want.
I think it's more on our end. I think there's some GAA chat, some Gaelic games about to be recorded in this studio, Bruce.
Gotcha.
So it's on our end. Apologies, but Conor McGregor against Khabib Nurmagomedov. It's only 6 weeks away, 5 weeks perhaps at this point. A quick prediction here: how's it going to go? Is this potentially the best fighter that Conor McGregor has ever come up against?
Well, on paper, I would say so. I mean, Conor's fought some amazing fighters in the UFC, and you know, Conor's career is awesome. So with Khabib coming in. Khabib's a monster. We know that. On the ground, he's a monster. He's an undefeated fighter. It's going to be a war, and it's all about may the best man win. The one big thing that Khabib, in my opinion, has got to watch out for is that right hand of Conor's, you know, that piston he has for a right hand. And a piston, what I mean is, you know, boom. Mm. For that first two rounds of that fight, because that right hand of Conor's can put down an elephant. You know, he's got amazing power in it. That's the key thing that Khabib's got to stay away from, as Conor, I don't think, wants to initially go to the ground with Khabib. So Conor's great at using his distance. He's great at creating distance. He's great when he wants to hit something, his hand-eye coordination, his hand-to-foot coordination, he usually hits everything he goes for. But he works on his distance, and the way he plants and turns his body into his punches and his kicks, he hits with tremendous power. So if he can keep a distance on Khabib, then that could be a long night for Khabib.
Sure.
Right? But Khabib gets Conor down on the ground initially, and Conor's sprawl does not negate that takedown, it could be a long night for Conor. So I never designate or say who's going to win. My attitude has always made the best man or woman win, because I like to introduce everybody equally. I never bet on fights. I just, you know, I'll analyze them based on what I see on paper. But it's going to be a great night. We're all looking forward to it. We've been waiting for this fight for a long time.
Oh, we sure have. And we're also looking forward to the hype to really kick in, because, you know, around Conor McGregor, you can call it a circus or whatever it is, we're all going to pay attention. We're all going to watch the press conferences just as closely as we're going to watch the fight. And I'm not sure, like we mentioned before you went on air, that you've been over here a few times. And like the Irish public is kind of like the worldwide public when it comes to their view of Conor McGregor. There are mixed emotions towards him, mixed opinions. He is like Marmite, as we say over here. You know, some people love him, some people hate him. And I do think what happened in Brooklyn earlier on this year has kind of swayed a little bit more in terms of public opinion against Conor McGregor, and that's kind of all around the world. And I'm not sure about you, but does it leave a little bit of a sour taste that the Brooklyn incident, the footage from that day in the Barclays Arena, is being used to promote this very fight when it is the very thing that kind of threatens to disrupt the purity that we often see in the UFC?
You know, marketing minds at the UFC who put this stuff together, these promos and these commercials, there's a reason. A method to their madness, shall we say, as the term goes. Obviously, being a person of class and respect and everything that I lead my life with, it was very upsetting, that incident. And I went public and talked about it when I was asked by TMZ and such. What I'm hoping for is that, USC is going to do whatever they want to do to promote the fight. And the fact that you mentioned, too, that there's a split of fandom in Ireland a little bit since that incident with Conor is, I gather, what you said.
Yes. Yeah. Even before that incident, to be honest with you, Bruce.
I think a lot of that maybe stemmed from the way Conor handled himself at the Mayweather press conferences, which started that feeling. Because I was hearing this from Irish fans.
No, you're right.
Travels. And then it culminated into the horrific incident at Barclays. But, you know, Conor went to court. They gave him the sentence they gave him, the justice that they laid down, which means, like anybody, he served, you know, he's paying his penance, shall we say.
Sure.
So now it's on to fight and everything else. Your question is about the promo being used. I was a little surprised, but, you know, again, you've got half the people that want to see Conor win. You've got the other half, let's say, that want to see him lose for the reasons that we're discussing, or whatever reasons. which means that everybody's going to buy the pay-per-view. You know, that's the bottom line. I just hope that Conor, being the great warrior that he is, having the incredible backstory that he has, which I was hoping would make him one of the greatest role models in history to the young people out there watching him and everything, handling himself in a proper fashion. Let's just hope that Conor learns whatever he needs to learn from the incident that took place and becomes a better and a greater role model as Conor McGregor, being the worldwide personality and popular personality is. You know, with fame comes responsibility and greatness. With greatness comes responsibility, as they say. Yeah. And that responsibility, I think, is to be a good role model for those of you watching. But Conor McGregor is going to be who he is, which is Conor McGregor. He's not going to be who he believes he is. He's going to stick to that mold. So I just hope he's learned from it and becomes an even better person than he already is the best way I can put it.
Yeah, well said. Well put, Bruce. Listen, there's so much more we'd love to chat to you about, but we are unfortunately out of time. Bruce Buffer, it's been fantastic having you on. Thanks a million for taking the call.
Thank you so much. And I'd like to invite everybody. I do a lot of recordings for weddings and birthdays and championship introductions that many of the fans from Ireland, you know, order for me through my website, brucebuffer.com. I really want to thank everybody because your thank you notes you're sending in, my partner and I, it's actually Kristen, you know, she does all the work. And it's like, well, sometimes I get tears in my eyes with some of these thank yous. It's amazing. I'm so happy to do this for the fans.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if we can get a quick taster, if you can say you're watching Off the Ball.
Hi, this is Bruce Buffer, and you're watching Off the Ball. Cheers.
That was amazing. That's a dream come true right there, Bruce. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. You know what? Thank you. I love your set. You do a great job. This is what makes our sport and the other sports that you promote who we are today. It's people like you and the fans, and I just want to thank you. I've been in this game a long time, and you're a class act, and I want to thank you very much for having me on your show.
No, thank you. Thanks a million, and great Dr. No poster. We'll chat to you soon, Bruce.
Oh, thank you. Cheers, mate. Bye-bye.
So, if you like this, you'll probably also like OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 a.m.